This episode I'm joined by John Michael Greer, who is an American author and blogger. He currently blogs at echosophia.net, and his most recent books include The Occult Book, A Chronological Journey from Alchemy to Wicca, and The Retro Future, Looking to the Past to Remake the Future. Enjoy.
Okay, we're recording. So the first question is the one you kind of unique to this podcast, the Hermetics question. If you could place three thinkers, living or dead, in a room and listen in, which three would you pick?
Oh my, that's a great question. Presuming they all magically could speak each other's language.
Yeah.
I would want. Friedrich Wilhelm Nietzsche would unquestionably be one of them, simply because he was one of the most fascinating men who's ever lived, and what a conversationalist. Let's see, who would I put along with him? I would want Iamblichus Calchas, the guy who transformed Neoplatonist philosophy into the basis for the magical traditions we still follow today. Absolutely whip smart guy, totally different take on the world than Nietzsche. Listening to the two of them would be great. And then to mediate between the two of them and get them talking, Dion Fortune.
Okay, so it's
I want those three in a room. I want to be a fly on the wall. I want a tape recorder going the whole time. That would be an experience.
I wonder who would come out sort of as the not the leader, but who would lead that conversation.
That's a really, really good question, because we're talking about three people who had really, really strong egos, were really forthright about their opinions, and who all held their opinions in the teeth of an enormous amount of popular, general disdain or disagreement. So, assuming that you could keep, pass on a beer or something and get everyone relaxed enough that they didn't get into a fight, it would be a wild ride.
Yeah. I think as well with Nietzsche, it would depend on which era of Nietzsche. If it's late Nietzsche, he might be a bit worried as to why he's even been put in there in the first place, I think.
Well, if he's late Nietzsche on the edge of nervous breakdown, it could get really colorful. But I'm hoping Nietzsche right around the time of also Sprach Zarathustra. Okay. That's what I would want.
So,
when he was dead, at his peak as a writer. Peak Nietzsche, yes.
Okay. So in doing the research for this interview, I sort of was trying to find a starting point. And so it's actually coincidental that one of the starting points of your now old blog, Arch Druid Report, is an article called Real Druids, which actually in itself is sort of a starting point, because you talk about, if we could go back to when Druidism was rife, wrong word, and you're saying that Druidism is sort of the path we should have taken. I wondered, that would be the path away from industrialization. I wondered if you could expand on that.
Well, basically, you always look back in history and look at the roads we didn't take. And there were a number of points along the way where we could have gone down a different way, where we could have made use of the discoveries of science in a way that wasn't so obviously destructive to the natural world. And the Druid revival of the 18th century, part of what that was doing was showing one of those directions. And, we didn't take it. You could make much more money turning the Midlands into one vast cinder field, and so that's what they did. But it's easy to be smart in retrospect, but a lot of people did notice, even back in the 18th century, just how destructive the industrial system was being, how destructive it was to nature, but also to human beings. I mean, when you think of the millions of people who basically ended up driven off the land by the Enclosure Acts, forced to work at starvation wages for 12 and 16 hour days in nightmare factories until they died. And that was the only life available to them, unless they could scrape up the money to emigrate, to leave for North America or Australia or someplace. there were plenty of better futures or better pasts at this point that we could have had, and unfortunately we didn't, and now we're kind of paying the price for that.
Yeah, yeah. It's interesting actually when John Zerzan was the interview prior to this, and he talks about how the past maybe 6 to 9,000 years is, you know, that's a blip against the 2 million of hunter gatherer society. But I think perhaps there's an argument there for, is there an in between? I mean, where does I mean, I hope druidism is a correct phrasing.
Some people call it druidism, some people call it druidry. As with almost everything having to do with druids, we don't have an orthodoxy. We're allergic to orthodoxies, so people use different terms. But with regard to a middle ground, though, I think one of the things that we think we know and we don't is that there were 2 million years of just hunter-gatherer cultures before the first civilizations emerged after the Ice Age. We don't actually know that. All we know is that our first traces of things, first written records date from about 5,000 years ago. The first cities that archaeologists have discovered and paid any attention to date from about 8 to 9,000 years ago. Right about the time that the chaos at the end of the last ice age was finally mellowing out, there's actually been for many, many years some evidence that there were fairly, complex human societies during the ice age. We don't see a lot of them these days because all of what was the good, temperate agricultural land in those days is now under anything up to 300 feet of water because, of course, the oceans rose when all the glaciers melted. So, I understand what Zerzan is saying, but we don't actually know what was going on over that 2 million year period. And jumping to a conclusion on the basis that our only alternative is a hunter-gatherer society because that's what everyone's doing back then, we don't know that. And we need to be a little more cautious about that.
So their personal form of anthropology is sort of kind of extrapolating a very, taking the assumption from very, very minor data and, clearly swaying towards their bias.
Mm-hmm. All of our views of the past are always about the present. It's like all of our visions of the future are always a reflection of the present. So if you read science fiction from 50 years ago, it is so dated, and it is so obviously of its own period. And the same is true if you read, say, a novel of historical fiction was written in 1920. You're going, oh my God, this is so 1920, even if it's supposed to be about ancient Rome or something. So, yeah, we use the past as a source of narratives to explain the present. And so, Zerzan has one set of explanations, which is based on, as you say, the very limited data that we have. And various other people have others. You have the mythology of progress, that everyone was living in squalor and misery until, this great march of progress from the caves to the stars, all that nonsense. All of these stories are designed to give structure to the world, to show us how to think about our present lives. And, of course, which story you choose makes a lot of difference, but it also makes a lot of difference if you can stop and step back and say, hold it, these are just stories we're telling ourselves.
Yeah, one of your pieces that I agreed with wholeheartedly was your article on stories. And so when you know no stories, you're ignorant. When you know one, you're along the lines of sort of totalitarian kind of ideology or bigotry, kind of bigotry towards your own idea. And once you start to understand and even maybe sympathize with multiple stories, that's when you start becoming at least a tad wise. You mentioned progress there, and I found in your writing you do this very interesting thing with definitions, and two that come to mind are the definition of progress and the definition of technology. So what do you do you see a point where this current mythology around the word progress kind of where that came from?
Oh yeah. Basically what happened was at what historians clumsily call the early modern period, the period right after the Renaissance, say the 1600s. You had what was called the Battle of the Books, this big cultural struggle across Europe, and it was a struggle between what they call the ancients and the moderns. There were people who were saying, look, you know, we need to learn from the past, all this, we've rediscovered all this marvelous stuff from ancient Greece, ancient Rome, that's what we should be studying, we should be recovering everything that they knew, da da da. Then you had the moderns who were saying, no, the past is crap, we need to go charging boldly onward, here's this marvelous new experimental science that a guy named Galileo has started to discover. You know, there are all these fantastic possibilities. Listen to Francis Bacon, what he's saying. We can make this a future that's completely unlike anything that's ever happened before, and it'll be wonderful. You know which side won. It was the moderns. Mm-hmm. And they created, as part of that, the story they told was the story that most people in the modern industrial world treat as simple fact, that, you know, in the past everyone sort of glumped around in misery and squalor, living in caves, getting chewed on by saber-toothed cats and so on. And then someone had a bright idea. And the whole series of bright ideas, everything gets better and better and better, until eventually we go zooming off to some kind of Star Trek destiny, you know, metastasizing across the galaxy or something. That came out of that early modern period, the triumph of the moderns, as they were called then, the triumph of this narrative of progress, which was also heavily tied, of course, to the rise of mercantile capitalism, the rise of the very first versions of industry. So it had a strong economic component. There were a lot of people who were making money off of this. And that's really been what's been driving it ever since. I mean, progress these days is mostly a marketing slogan for the latest technological crap.
Yeah, that was the second definition, and it made me smile when I was reading your work. When you bring up technology, in my opinion, and I don't know if you'd agree, technology probably, you know, for a long time that word has actually just meant gadgetry innovation. You know, and then you bring mm-hmm. this to the fore by kind of saying, well, a slide rule is technology.
A slide rule is technology. Yeah. A stone axe, a stone hand axe is technology. Technology is anything you use that's not part of your body mm-hmm. to accomplish something. Okay? You pick up a club. Okay, that's technology. But we've got this delusion that anything that's newer must be better. Anything that's more complex must be better. And in fact, if you actually pay attention, you'll notice that many of the latest, hot, innovative, cutting-edge new technologies don't work as well as the lower-tech things they replace.
Oh, yeah. There's a big thing, I think it was a few years ago now, where Gillette advertised their new 5-blade razor. And yeah, I know. Every year they get another blade, don't they? And all the comments, mm-hmm. though, were people saying, well, I've had my, you know, my double-edge or my, cutthroat razor. I've had them, you know, since, you know, probably a hand-me-down. Mm-hmm. It's like, you know, you can't improve. There's a point with many, many things where you just simply
you can't improve them. Yeah. The United States military is the poster child for this. For some reason, the folks in the Pentagon have this fetish for the latest cutting-edge stuff. And what has happened is that we've turned out one brand-new innovative military technology after another that doesn't work. We've got this brand new aircraft carrier, the USS Gerald Ford. It has these really innovative catapults to launch aircraft. They don't work. They can't make. They're throwing vast amounts of money down a variety of rat holes trying to make these things work. If they put in a simple, ordinary steam catapult of the kind that's been being used since the 1930s, they have planes popping off them like anything. But guess what? A few years ago, the entire Department of Defense brought in this brand new digital high-tech camouflage for their uniforms, okay? Uh-huh. And then they scrapped it after a few years because it stood out like a sore thumb against every single environment on Earth.
Oh. Yeah.
And I could go on. Innovation does not necessarily equal improvement. Once you've figured out what works, further steps are likely to work less well, and then you end up with the Gillette razor with 37 blades, which you can't even fit on your face.
Yeah, just an entire face mask of razors.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, face mask razor. You just got to put it on and wiggle it up and down.
It wouldn't surprise me. It really wouldn't.
I would not be surprised for one minute.
is this whole progress technology dynamic sort of a, I mean, just a quick anecdote. I mean, I was my neighbor got a dishwasher, and I was perhaps quite curmudgeonly saying, you know, but you still have to like half wash the dishes before they go in, otherwise mm-hmm. it gets all clogged. So really, it's like a 75% clean plate washer. You know, it's like it's the most amazingly marketed thing. It's basically useless. But is this a massive sunk cost? You know, from the Enlightenment onwards, it's just been like sunk cost.
Exactly. And the usual sunk cost fallacy, what sensibly enough was called not too many years ago, the Concord fallacy. We've thrown all this money down this rat hole. We can't stop now, even though it doesn't pay for itself. Even though, you know, there are all these good reasons not to use it, even though it's a complete flop, we've got to keep on doing it. The same logic that kept the U.S. fighting in Vietnam for so many years and still has us in the Middle East. You know, we can't let ourselves fail, even though it just means we're going to throw more money down that rat hole before we fail.
So this is sort of a culture where limit and horizon are never acknowledged.
Oh, yeah.
You know, I mean, I don't know how you feel about that, if there's anything you could add.
Oh, no, absolutely. Absolutely. I was once invited to go to this this event on nature spirituality, this beautiful resort up in the Sandalwood Islands of Washington State. There we were, and you know, there was kind of a token druid, and we sit around. And there's this big thing where everyone's supposed to spend like 7 minutes talking about some really important spiritual lesson that they draw from nature. Okay, and people are vaporing about this, and they're blathering about that, and they're talking about the other thing, and my turn comes, I get the talking stick, and I proceed to say, well, the lesson I see from nature is that the reality and goodness of limits, and the temperature in the room dropped basically 30 degrees on the spot. It was watching everybody bristle. And now, mind you, most of these people had driven there, you know, these nature spirituality types, they'd driven there all by themselves in big SUVs. And, they, you know, in terms of nature, they had no contact with it other than, you know, watching programs on the TV or something. I was spending my time going out and, you know, walking on the beach and things like that. I'm a druid. I spend my time in nature. But yeah, talking about limits, people are terrified of that, and wrongly so. Mm-hmm. I mean, right now, I'm sitting on a chair, okay? That chair is limiting the capacity of my butt from bouncing off the floor, and I'm glad of that. Yeah. I mean, I can stand up because my bones have limits. My skin has limits. You know, we exist... Limits are good. Limits are what make it possible for us to do anything at all. And this terror of limits, I think, is one of the reasons that so many people just sit around spinning their wheels doing nothing. They won't accept limits, and so they never get anything done.
If I kind of almost gratuitously expand your metaphor of the chair as limit...
Go ahead. Go ahead.
You know, I can take that as the chair there is sort of... is the natural world. So is there an implication there that certain things like the space race and AI, even though I know you're highly critical of these coming about, that if they could or will, that would be a bad, like that would be a break of something we shouldn't have done?
The thing is, there have been technologies that have succeeded, quote unquote, that unquestionably were really, really bad ideas. Nuclear power is a great example. But there are things that we could do that would further damage our relationship with the natural world, that would further damage our ability to function as human beings. The whole AI business, partly that's, if I may be blunt, that's class prejudice. Have you noticed that none of the AI applications are going to make, you know, throw people out of work who work as bankers and stockbrokers and executives, even though it's really easy to do their jobs with AIs? No, they want to put truck drivers out of work. It's part of a general bigotry that's very pervasive in modern industrial society against working class people. And, you know, classism is just runs all through, and nobody will talk about it because, you know, the yobs, the working class people with too few teeth who live in flyover states or things like that, they're the one group it's totally okay to hate in most of the modern industrial societies. But yeah, the thing is, all of these things, it's based on an attempt to take fairy tales and make them real rather than learning from them. You know, you get something like Rumpelstiltskin. We all remember the story of Rumpelstiltskin who spun straw into gold. Okay, and it's a good story. And if you pay attention to it and learn from it, you can learn a lot of things about the world. But instead, we have people going, ooh, we can make, you know, gold out of straw, so we have Bitcoin. Or various other speculative gimmicks, which are basically our attempts to make straw out of gold, or gold out of straw, rather. We'll find that it's going the other way around.
I fundamentally disagree with you on Bitcoin, but that's
okay.
Or cryptocurrency in general, but that's a long... But then, like, I guess in terms of your own... speculations with regard to collapse, something as such as Bitcoin is, but I mean, gold doesn't even make sense within a collapse dynamic, right?
No. The thing is, if your value consists of what you have stockpiled, somebody eventually is going to come and take your stockpile, out from under your steaming corpse. Okay, the whole problem with the notion that we can just stash lots of stuff and be okay no matter what happens, that's been tried. If you go into any good museum in Britain that has a good archaeological collection, you'll find stashes of gold coins from Roman villas. What happened was that when Roman Britain was going down, the Saxons were showing up at the shores, they were getting raids from the Picts, all this kind of stuff. A lot of rich Roman British people thought, hey, I know what I can do. So they got a lot of gold together, and they tucked it into a secret place near their villa, and they were going to be just fine. Except, of course, what happened was the Saxons came through anyway, slaughtered them all, took the gold they could find, and moved on.
Yeah.
That's what happens. If you want to make it, if you want to preserve value in an environment of social decline, you need to learn skills. Because if you can do something for other people that they value, they're going to keep you alive. In the pirate societies of the Caribbean, probably the most lawless human societies that have ever existed, if you were a physician, if you were a shipwright, if you were any of a dozen other specialties that they needed, like a gunsmith or so on, nobody would harm you. They knew they needed you. So, you know, the drunken pirates would go, hey, hi there, hire me, mateys, and just they hand you a beer, and then go off and murder someone else because they were in a mood to just cut someone's throat. So this is the basic thing. If you in an environment of decline, if you want to preserve wealth, learn skills, and develop connections with your neighbors, that's what gets you through in one piece.
Okay. That's very concise. And I just wanna take a step back before we kind of get into the collapse stuff, which I'd like to mix in with the occult stuff, because I actually think there's a kind of
connection.
But with regards to limit and progress and technology, there's a there's a question I've actually been dying to ask you. And I'm are you aware of these kind of very niche, small philosophical camp of accelerationism?
The only thing that brings to mind is a detail out of a Roger Zelazny science fiction novel. So no, I'm not. Tell me about accelerationism.
So I'll try to keep this concise, but the general premise is if we take for granted that capitalism in its current form is not really what many parties wanted. So for instance, libertarianism's wanted a different form of they wanted, you know, laissez-faire, free trade. Conservatives probably wanted it held back a little more, etc., etc. Like each camp has their own thing, and we ended up with this form that we have currently, which sort of nobody wanted, at least as it is. The accelerationist premise is the only way out is through, to accelerate the process of technocapital. I don't know what you'd make of that as a means of escape.
That was Trotsky's claim: worse is better. Trotsky's idea was that the Marxists should do their best to accelerate all the worst features of capitalism so that the revolution would come sooner. Didn't work too well, but it was an interesting speculation. There is, I think, a mistaken idea here that individuals make history happen. And I would argue that is indeed a mistake, that it involves perhaps an overdeveloped sense of entitlement or something like it. But that just as the capitalism we got was not the capitalism that anybody particularly wanted. It's a capitalism that happened to evolve that way. The decline and collapse of capitalism will happen on its own time frame, in its own way, pretty much regardless of who does or doesn't do what. That's my take at any rate. I mean, if the accelerationists feel differently, by all means, let them knock themselves out.
Well, yeah, there's different camps which sort of aim towards different things.
Sure. And of course, that's another of the reasons why they probably won't succeed, because they're all pulling in 15 different directions, just like the people who created capitalism.
Who I mean, that's a very, quite a bold statement. Who do you see as the creators of capitalism?
The creators of capitalism were tens of thousands, perhaps millions, of individual entrepreneurs over a 400-year period who each grabbed hold of something they thought they could make money at and ran with it. None of them planned to create capitalism. It just happened that way.
Okay. Yeah, sort of like...
And in exactly...
Your comment about the dancing Santa Claus animatronic, you know, it just happens.
Exactly. It happened. Somebody thought they could make some money doing that. That's to my mind, that's kind of the final output, the peak expression of our capitalist industrial societies, electronic dancing Santa Clauses that used to lurch their way through a little song and dance routine. This is what it all came down to. Oh well, I wonder what our descendants will think of that.
It's like strewing through the scraps of a decaying dystopian society and the last remnant of a gyrating Santa Claus's hip, kind of.
There we are. Or, 2,000 years from now, archaeologists digging up a rubbish tip, okay? And here they find a Santa Claus, one of these Santa Clauses that had been chucked in there after the circuitry broke down. And they're going, I bet it was a religious idol. Yeah. They worshipped it.
That's the premise of... Boy, that sci-fi novel has completely skipped my mind.
Which one?
Canticle for Leibovitz.
Canticle for Leibovitz, yeah. And that was the beginning of a whole genre of post-collapse science fiction novels, and there was some really interesting stuff that came out of that. Mm-hmm. I actually wrote one a few years back, which is still in print, called Stars Reach, which is set in late 25th century America, as it's called then. Dark Age America, Dark Age North America, basically.
Okay. You have a very clear critique of what's known as collapse culture, which I think concisely can be said that, people take the word collapse as a singular, like, instantaneous event. And you make it very, very clear in many, many books of yours that collapse is a process. Is there any other critiques of the culture that you have? Terms of how it's presented?
Yeah, basically the thing to watch with collapse culture is that the idea of instant collapse is an excuse. It's an opportunity for moralizing. It's an opportunity for wish fulfillment fantasies. It's an opportunity for wallowing in ersatz guilt. It's basically been turned into a resource for emotional displays. And one of the ways you can see that is the way that people keep recycling the same predictions over and over again, even when they failed over and over and over and over. So some of the people have been doing this every year. This is going to be the year the stock market collapses. This is going to be the year we run out of oil, da-da-da-da. And that 12 months from now, they're going to say exactly the same thing. Because it's not about, they're not actually talking about the future. Again, I mentioned, our talk about the future is partly about the present. In this case, it's wholly about the present. It's an excuse for emotional expression. And that's fine, but it'd be nice if it was treated as such and not treated as having anything to do with the future. One of the things that I have had the amusing fortune to do repeatedly over the last dozen years or so since I started this project, is make predictions, and then I go back to them a year later and point out, okay, I missed that, and that, but I got all these other things right. And so one of the things that collapse culture consistently pretends that history doesn't matter and that there's nothing to learn from it. And that's why it keeps on making bad predictions, because if you don't correct your, if you don't check your predictions against what happens and correct your errors, you're just going to be wrong.
Yeah, I mean, the morality of collapse culture, actually, now you point it out, is sort of the inverse of unalloyed progress, because if you've got an imminent collapse coming up, well, then nothing matters, everything's going to break. If everything's progressing constantly, nothing matters because everything's great. So the in between is the difficult point with regard to self.
Well, yeah, because you're quite right. Because essentially, collapse culture takes the emotional tone and the moral claims of progress. Nothing matters because it's all taken care of one way or the other, and uses that to hide from the very awkward reality that, well, you know, maybe it isn't all taken care of. Maybe it does matter. Maybe how we live our lives actually makes a difference. And of course, that's loaded. I promise you, you can get people in a quite a state of tizzy by pointing out, well, you know, how are you living your life?
You mentioned the, I can't remember the family's name, but they lived a Victorian lifestyle, just, and kept to themselves mostly, and you know, the whole town gets aggressive.
Yeah, well, no, fortunately not the whole town, but they were constantly being harassed by people who were horribly offended by the fact that, you know, this particular family likes to live a Victorian lifestyle. They dress in Victorian clothes, they ride, penny-farthing bicycles. That's what they do because they enjoy it. And they got all this shrieking. I get a certain amount of heat because I haven't owned a television my whole life. I find TV incredibly boring, and it's not the program; it's the programming. It's a matter of, you know, looking at little jerky colored pictures jerking around on a glass screen just bores the bejesus out of me. So I don't have a television. When this comes out, a certain number of people get acutely uncomfortable. And they start going, well, you've got to have a television. You've got to watch this stupid show or that boring show. You know, I'm obviously putting words in their mouths there. But no, people get really uneasy when you don't conform. You don't conform to the orthodoxy of progress. You're not doing what you're told. And that's just really, really uncomfortable for a lot of people to deal with.
Yeah, I found your you mentioned your personal opinion of TV as an activity a couple of times. I mean, maybe just very briefly. So how do you feel about things such as films? Is it more the apathetic kind of binge watching, or is there?
Partly, I'm just not greatly into visual media. My wife and I will very occasionally watch a DVD. But you know, that might happen 3 times a year. Mm-hmm. We're just not much into visual media. If I want to learn something, I pick up a book. I can get more out of that faster and have a more pleasant time. But you know, I have kind of quiet notions of what an interesting evening is like. You know, here I am sitting on the couch with a good book and a glass of whiskey. I'm set. But I am not by saying, you know, I'm not much into visual media. I'm not saying visual media is bad. I do think that a case could be the television technology is very problematic because it's an addictive drug. People do seriously become addicted to television.
The problem with it, as I find, is it's an apathetic medium. It requires nothing from the person who's interacting. You could be knocked out and just opened your eyes in front of it, and you'd be doing the same as someone who's actually watching it. You know?
Yeah, and it not only doesn't require any involvement, it encourages the apathy. And there's actually some effects, some flicker effects, and so on that actually influence your brainwaves in the direction of passivity. So it's, you know, I tend to advise people who ask me, you know, what's your recommendation? You know, you write all these books, you do all these things, you have this interesting life that you're doing. How do you do it? And I tell them, just don't have a television. You'll have 4 to 6 more hours a day. Yep. And some people do it, and they go, wow, this is incredible. And some people go, yeah, I don't want to watch TV. And it's fine. You know, it's not a religious crusade. It's just, I'm saying, if you want a life, you can have a television, you can have a life if you pick.
Yeah. Well, I've had the exact same response when with regard to Facebook, and I've said the same thing to people when they've with a podcast and do a degree and then full time work, and they say, how do you find the time to do all this? And I just said, I don't have Facebook and I don't have, you know, Netflix. It's like those two things aren't there to kind of draw me in and just and you can fill indefinite time lusting at everyone else's lives. And I'm simply not interested in other people's lives enough.
Yeah. You know, there are other things. You can have your own life, or you can follow other people's lives. Take your pick. I'd rather have my own life.
Yeah, exactly.
I'm also not on Facebook, by the way. I have better things to do.
Yeah, I mean, that's... I don't... Once again, it's an activity. Once you deconstruct it, if you were to do it in any other form, if you had just a journal of your friend's meals, why would you read it?
Mm-hmm. You know? That's a really good point. Yeah, I like that. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, you know. It's,
Imagine a newspaper published every day that had, you know, the listings of everything. Yeah, every hour someone plots a paper on your desk and it has, you know, stuff about what your friends are eating that day.
Yeah.
Would you subscribe? No, Socrates, you would not. It's incredibly dull.
Well, yeah, would you sit down or what? Yeah. Talking about TV, there's actually quite a current in occultism. It's just going to mind, actually. I'm thinking specifically, I know Robert Anton Wilson mentions it a few times, but I think there's a couple of other, at least, obviously, they have to be fairly modern occultists who advise against TV, so...
Mm-hmm. That's all. If somebody's interested in serious occult training, that's another matter. And I strongly recommend that they ditch their TV and be very careful about their consumption of visual media generally, because you need to have a clear imagination. You need to be able to imagine things that you want to imagine. You need to be able to build up imaginary images very clearly in your mind. It's much easier if you're not being overstimulated by television. And so, you know. That's become fairly common among serious occultists these days, and for good reason.
Well, it seems to be a common cultural trend now where if you're having a meal, you also put a podcast on, or if you're watching TV, you're also like, you know, it's like you have a hamburger and you have to have cheese, you know, you have to have the other piece.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think maybe this is why occultism is kind of, I mean, that's broad in this sense, but maybe this is why occultism has avoided quite a lot of the currents of consumerism and industrialization.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think it's a very important part of it. But there's also the simple fact that if you practice the occult disciplines, you're going to learn one of the major things you're going to develop is your own willpower. You're going to develop the power to make your own decisions, to assess your own life and say, I want to do this, I don't want to do that. You don't drift. You don't just sort of get batted about by your surroundings, by other people, by the media. Occult training will cure you of that quite promptly. And that's one, and of course, when somebody's choosing their own life and they're thinking about what they're doing and they're saying, okay, how am I going to spend the next 6 hours? The idea of looking at messages of what all your friends had for lunch is not going to be high on that list. And more generally, a lot of consumer goods, they're sold to people who don't think. Because, I mean, if you actually took a moment to think about the dancing Santa Claus and said, okay, I'm going to spend X number of pounds for this object, and what am I getting back for it? If you actually walk through that, you're not going to buy the thing. You're going to go put the money into something you're actually going to enjoy. It sells to the people who have been conditioned to go, ooh, want, buy, clunk, you know. There's the mechanical response, which people fall into very easily. One thing to keep in mind, human beings are not that smart. Human beings are social primates. We are not, you know, these glorious, you know, powerful beings destroying the universe. We're a bunch of bawling monkeys, okay? And we're not as smart as we think we are, and so it's very easy for us to get caught up doing really stupid things like buying animatronic Santa Clauses. If you stop and learn to think, you can avoid some of those things, and so occultists very often do, and very often you get. So you get, you know, the people who are actually looking at the animatronic Santa Claus and going, why? Now, various of them come from they may have various reasons, but you're going to find some cultists in that who are just going, why? No, I'm going to spend this off on something else. Or I'm not going to spend it. I'm going to tap it and save the same account and use it later. Or what have you.
I know your recommended form of meditation for sort of first time or beginner people who are beginning within the occult is a form of, so I guess you'd call it
focused meditation, where you focus on a single thought and follow that through. Mm-hmm. So is that the first iteration of that is to focus on the dancing Santa Claus?
Well, you could certainly do that. Yeah, the method is called discursive meditation, and it's kind of the opposite of the sort of meditation that's been very popularized as far as, you know, Asian meditations. We hear a lot about various kinds of meditations that are designed to shut up the mind, to stop you from thinking. Now, that has its place now and again, but my immediate thought has always been, we need people to think more, not to think. Hello?
Yeah, definitely.
Okay, you're still here. Good. Yeah. The thing just beeped at me. But we need people to think more rather than to think less. And that's really interesting. It's doing the beep thing pretty consistently. Maybe it's that think more rather than think less. Okay, it wasn't that. And so discursive meditation, you're basically entering into a meditative state. You're using rhythmic breathings, relaxing your body, all this kind of stuff, bringing up a concept or a symbol or an image, something you want to think about, and just taking it apart in your mind and turning it over and thinking about it, all while maintaining that meditative focus. It's a very powerful tool. A lot of people who have difficulty with like mantra meditation or what have you find it much easier. And it also has the side effect that you end up much better at thinking, much better at thinking clearly. So you can look at the animatronic dancing Santa Claus, whether in meditation or otherwise, and go, why would anyone want that? You know, it's going to sit on the counter and lurch about until the battery runs out or until something breaks, which will probably happen sooner. And then what? Then it goes into a landfill to be discovered 2,000 years from now by some archaeologist.
Yeah, I mean, there was, you mentioned the mindful contemporary mindfulness meditation is sort of tainted by the West. There seems to be, I mean, perhaps I might get the era wrong here, but with just after the 60s and then into the early 70s, there was sort of this rebirth of spiritual culture with a Western price tag. So there was like transcendental meditation, and then I'm right in thinking transcendental meditation is just mantra meditation.
That's correct.
With a big price tag.
And then you had several other things go the same way. And now mindfulness meditation is the standard thing. In all of these cases, these very heavily marketed systems have one thing in common. They've had all the spiritual content stripped out of them. Mm-hmm. Mindfulness meditation, as it's practiced by Vipassana monks in, say, Thailand or what have you, is very potent stuff, but it's done in the context of a whole series of other spiritual disciplines that sort of frame it and direct it and make sure it doesn't run off the rails. What's being sold to Westerners these days has been stripped of all that. It's just this bare technique, which mostly functions as a non-chemical tranquilizer to keep people calm while they go out their nice corporate jobs. Fortune 500 corporations are paying for their employees to do mindfulness meditation. They're not doing that because they love you.
I mean, I spoke to this author, John Cussons, who says he jokes with his Marxist friends because they talk about, you know, capitalists will commodify air. Well, I think perhaps it's a step worse that they've commodified sitting and being silent.
They managed to commodify you. Yeah, they managed to commodify the process of just sitting there.
Yeah, as soon as you wake up, they charge you for being a being. Wow.
Exactly. Yeah. No. I have my disagreements with some aspects of Marxist thought, but the Marxist analysis of capitalism is pretty spot on.
Mm-hmm. Where do you split with Marx then?
Basically, I've always been very impressed by a comment that was quite commonly heard in Russia after the collapse of the Soviet Union, which is everything Marx said about communism was wrong, but everything he said about capitalism was right. So Marx's analysis of the capitalist system and its problems and its trajectory has an enormous amount to offer. When Marxist theory starts talking about the revolution and how we're going to eat all these strawberries and cream afterwards, and you know, the socialism giving way to communism, the withering away of the state, that's nonsense. It doesn't work that way. Never has, never will. So ditch the warmed over apocalyptic fantasies, which are borrowed basically from Christian heresies, and get back to the effective analysis of a dysfunctional capitalist system. I have no problem with Marxism, but you know, it's that utopian streak that you get in the Marxist looking for, you know, keep a steel helmet ready, boys. The revolution will come every day. Or any day, and that happens every day, mm-hmm. And you know.
Would you sort of argue there that, I mean, revolution is not a nice word to put next to anything spiritual, but would you argue that the important revolution is, and this could be quoted and put on a picture of a sunset, but would you argue that the important revolution is the one that you are undertaking spiritually?
You have to free your mind, or you don't free anything else.
Okay,
you have to start by freeing your mind. One of the reasons that Marxist revolutions always simply end up repeating the same dreary consequence of, you know, establishing a regime worse than the one they replaced, mm-hmm. is precisely that everyone's the Marxist notion is that if you just change the way that the means of production are controlled and owned, then everyone will suddenly start acting like angels. Doesn't work. You have to actually, you know, and you have to change yourself, mm-hmm. before you can change the world. And as you change yourself, the world will change around you.
But it's not a form, because you're saying the word self there, and it's not a form of self which is actually, it's not a form of self that you hear of much anymore, because there's a big thing about identity at the moment. You know? And but that's so different to the self that you're speaking of there, isn't it?
No, when identity is what people use to hide from themselves. When you say, you know, I belong to this ethnic group. I belong to this gender. I am this. I am that. Sartre, the existentialist philosopher, used to talk about that all the time. He was actually talking about it in terms of Nazism, and pointed out that the great thing that the Nazi Party offered Germans was the opportunity to be something the way a rock is a rock. And it was a lie. But it was having this ersatz identity, having this thing that you can use so you don't have to pay attention to who you actually are. It's very, very popular. So we see that right now going on across the board in the political spectrum. You see it on the right, you see it on the left. You see, you know, the various racial activists from the white community. You see it from, you know, the men's right activists. You know, I am a man. You know, you have this nice little box into which you stuff yourself. You have exactly the same thing going on the opposite sides, where you have the various ethnic groups that are building identity around this and around that, or the gender identity, the class identity, the transgender identity. All of these things as ways to hide from what we actually, you know, what each of us actually is, alone, nameless, without these simple social categories in which we can hide. What are you? Mm-hmm. That's a question mystics have been asking for a very long time, and it makes a powerful thing just to sit, you know, doing the discursive meditation, you know. Get past the name, get past the label, get past the various identity markers. What are you?
If you go right back in the I was recently rereading Manly P. Hall's Secret Teachings of All Ages.
If
you go right back to luckily he actually extrapolates on Pythagoras more than any academic wants to. I noticed they really shy away from Pythagoras's mysticism.
Oh yeah,
but Pythagoras mentions that. Once you sort of realize something about yourself or about the way things are, the single worst, it's part of his eight, and I can't remember what they are, but once you realize this thing, the single worst thing you can do is then retreat back. So if you realize B, the worst thing you can do is, you know, retreat back to A. And I think it almost seems at the moment, I mean, and that's sort of the allegory of Plato's cave as well, And but it also very almost seems so. At the moment that a lot of society, I mean, what Nietzsche called the herd, Heidegger called the they, blah blah. You know,
there's a huge history of this.
Yeah, yeah.
But it seems at the moment that people almost know they're in the cave. They know at least of the outside of the cave, but they just don't want to even try. Like it's like they've you know, there's a tiny bit of sunlight coming through.
They've realised these might be puppets, but it's a bloody good puppet show, so I might stay here.
Yeah, exactly. And there's a huge amount of that. Watch the way that politics has degenerated into this bizarre screen fest where everyone's shrieking irrelevant comments at each other, and nothing is happening. Whether it's the federal budget on this side of the pond or the whole Brexit fandango over on your side of the pond, just all of this posturing and yelling and shrieking and fist pounding. And it's all a distraction. It's all, I'm going to get myself really bent out of shape about this so I don't have to notice what's actually going on. And I think one of the things that's actually going on is that it's really beginning to sink in a lot of people that the whole mythology of progress that we talked about isn't working, that we're not going to the stars, that we're not heading off to some glorious future, that industrial society has peaked and will decline in due time. I mean, I noticed that you remember the whole Mars One business a little while ago.
Yeah,
there was all this yelling about it, and they have gone bankrupt. But oh my word, that has been, you have to work to find that out. It's finally getting out there in the alternative media. But when they filed for bankruptcy,
like, it's gone bankrupt that we never even went.
I know. I know. But that's it. It's starting to sink in that we can't. There's a thing called provisional living. This is something that some psychologists talk about, some occult teachers talk about. Provisional living is this habit of saying, well, you know, everything wonderful, everything I'm ever going to dream is going to happen after this happens. Whether, you know, after I lose 20 pounds, or after I get the new job, or after I walk out on my wife, or after I do this or that or the other. And the trick with provisional living is that you never actually do the thing that's going to enable you to have this wonderful new life. So you can stick all of your dreams up there in the distance and ignore them and go on with your everyday life. That can break down in two ways. One of them, of course, is what happens if the thing happens. You know, what happens if all of a sudden you do leave the job, okay, and you've got the same life you did. But the other thing is what happens when the possibility goes away. And that's what a lot of people are dealing with right now. We're not going to the stars. We're not going to have this glorious, the glorious capitalist future. It's not going to happen. And people are noticing that, and they're wigging out. They're freaking out and finding other things to yell about because it allows them not to think about the consequences of what it means they've been lying to themselves for the last 300 years.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, and this is why one of my favorite Brexit predictions back in, I think it was about a month after it was all being, beginning. And someone said that, I think it was a prediction by an economist, and he said what will happen is in 10, 20 years, slowly there'll be choices and votes which will make it a less of a big thing, and it will, within 20 years, it will be like an anecdote, a footnote on Wikipedia. They'll say, did you know the UK was meant to actually leave the EU? And people will just forget about it. And it's, you know, and I thought that was brilliant because it doesn't cater to either side. It's like people, this is just going to be kind of very, very, very slowly pushed under the rug.
It's possible. And the thing is, if it doesn't, if Brexit happens and there's a little bit of turmoil and so on, 50 years from now, people go, yeah, that's right. Britain was a member of the EU for a while, wasn't it? It's not that big of a deal. It all looks really big now. Similarly, the number of people who are, you know, freaking out about this and that and the other thing in current American politics, 20 years from now, people are going to go, oh yeah, I remember Donald Trump. Kinda. It's one of those, you know, it's very easy to get whipped up into a tizzy about the events of the moment, especially if whipping yourself up into a tizzy allows you to distract yourself from the things you don't want to think about.
And
that's a lot of what's going on now.
I often feel that people who really, really whip themselves up, as you say, into a tizzy and are kind of screaming and crying at votes, I feel that, that's a form of signaling, though, you know. It's,
mm-hmm. It's a form of signaling. It's a way of declaring that you really, truly do believe in this thing that you no longer believe in. It's a way of claiming membership. There's all kinds of emotional games that are played by, you know, shrieking and falling down on the ground, writhing or what have you. Most 2-year-olds know how to do that very well. If you've ever seen a 2-year-old doing a really comprehensive tantrum, we get the adults doing that in American politics today.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so this to me is very important because it's something that I struggle with. So in terms of collapse and the kind of the social, you know, waking up and understanding at least some of this and understanding where we might be and also admitting it and accepting limits. So as an environmentalist, you know, when I go to my recycling bin with my tiny 4-pint milk, and I always think of, you know, your books when I'm doing it, because I think, why bother, John? You know, why bother recycling when? But I think that's a bigger form of nihilism in relation to. So how does one, in your opinion, if you have some form of answer, how do you avoid that form of? I don't know what you'd call it. You know, that form of nihilism.
No, the form of nihilism that says it doesn't matter, nothing I do can have any effect. First of all, you have to remember that that message is being pushed at you by industrial society in a very big way, night and day, by all the media that they have. You know, the idea is that if you dissent, if you don't conform, you can't possibly have an effect. That's a major message of the propaganda of industrial societies these days. And so it's not surprising that people have to wrestle with it, because it's being yelled at them all the time. The first thing to keep in mind is that every significant social change started with smaller people doing something differently. Every single one. Look back all through history at every positive change that's ever happened. What happened was that somebody decided, and they were one person, or it was a handful of people, it was a few people. We're in that state now when it comes to the environment. We're at the point where there were a few of us, there were a modest number of us, some people are recycling, some people are doing more than that. But, you know, and there are ups and downs. This also happens if you look at any significant movement for social change, there are ups and downs. There are periods when things seem to be going well, and there are periods where a lot of people turn their back and walk away, and you just have to keep on going, because you don't know where it's leading. It's only the voice of industrial society insisting on their version of progress that says, no, it can't possibly have an effect because we're going to the stars. Well, no, we're not. And so there's that. There's also the extent, and this is something that's very, you hear a lot of in the Druid community for obvious reasons, is that doing recycling, doing the other things can be a meditation, can be a spiritual discipline, can be a way of interacting with the world in a more authentic fashion. It doesn't matter if someone else is doing it. You're actually engaging the world in this way. And so you can approach it as a personal discipline, or approach it as a way of training, a way of relating to the cosmos. And there are real benefits from that, from approaching it that way. It's a very useful thing to do. So those are kind of the two approaches that I use. And also just the simple fact that the more I talk about this kind of thing, the more I just, you know, let people know, here are some of the options, the more people I meet who are doing them. Since I started talking about, get rid of your television, I know of probably 150 people who have said to me, you know, it was because you said that that I decided to try turning off my television, and I realized that I didn't miss it, and then I threw it away. And I've had this wonderful life, and I now play a musical instrument, and have a much better relationship with my family, and, you know, I'm looking here brewing beer, and this is all these things I didn't have time for. So personal example has enormous power. That's something that our society also insists can't happen, because, you know, you're only supposed to get your information from the media, right? But the power of personal example is real. And so, you know, get out there, accept it as a discipline, do the thing, let the universe decide what's going to happen.
Okay. Speaking of time, are you good to go on, or...?
I can go on for a little while longer. We should probably move forward when he's ended up, but yeah. I have to
okay. If we're moving towards winding on, I think one thing I'd like to ask is there's this running current through your books where often when you get near the end of your books, at least the ones about collapse in society, you always kind of quite hastily, and I like that it's like you talk about having value and having skills, and then at the end there's almost always the thing there to actually help people out, which you don't get in many collapse books at all, which is sort of an irony because it's like someone telling you everything's going to be bad and then hiding all their tactics, you know. You know, look how bad it's going to get for you, and then the book slams shut. So perhaps two points, two very quick routes to finish on would be, where would you advise people to start with occultism, and then secondly, what are maybe some smaller things that people could do in terms of, if they understand that collapse is a process, what are some smaller things they could do to alleviate descent?
Yeah. With regard to starting occultism, there's many different traditions, there are many different approaches, there is no one thing that fits everybody. The best thing to do is look around, read some books, try to get an idea of what appeals to you. There are plenty of websites and podcasts and things like that, so you can get an idea of what's available out there. I'm personally very partial to a lot of the old-fashioned schools. Many of which are still in existence, still have correspondence courses, what have you. But, you know, your mind is going to vary. With regard to things you can do to become aware of collapse, the thing that I highly recommend people do is start paying attention to where things come from in your life. We have this notion that the sort of notion that we're all given by the media, again, that stuff sort of just appears from nowhere and comes into our life and then goes away. And there's no such place as away. And so take a little while to learn, you know, where's your electricity coming from? Where's your fuel coming from? Where's your food coming from? Where's your water coming from? Where do your wastes go? Where does, you know, what's happening here? How do you already integrate into this broader system? And is there anything that you might want to change? Because very often, this is a thing that I call the replicator fallacy, which is based on the Star Trek universe. If people want something, they just go to a replicator and punch in a button. There it is. The real world does not work that way. Everything you use has come by some means, from some place, by somebody's labor. You know, a little bit of a Marxist element there also. You know, somebody's labor value has gone into this stuff. Everything you throw away, all of your waste, is going somewhere, is doing something, affects somebody. Learn that. But try to start seeing yourself not as this isolated little bubble, but as part of a process, part of a flow, in which you have some choice as to what you do and where things go. So that's what I'd advise.
Okay. I think that's a great place to finish.
Excellent.
Thanks very much.
Thank you very much.